Okay, but it's a pleasure to welcome everybody. Erev Tov, and it's a pleasure to welcome Sarah Gordon, who, as I said, I want to wish her a triple mazel tov. Since she last spoke, she got married and has two kids and living in Teaneck. So it's a pleasure to welcome her back. She is the Senior Director of Israel Education, I don't know, AMAR for Unpacked for Educators, part of Open Door Media. I'm sure many of you have heard of Open Door Media, do all these media productions for Israel, etc. She previously served as Director of Israel Guidance and Experiential Education. I'm curious what that means. At Maayanot High School, where she taught Talmud and shared a course in contemporary Israel. She spent 2 years in the GPATH program at Stern College as a dual master's degrees in Jewish education and modern Jewish history from Yeshiva University, where she is now pursuing her EdD as a Wexner Fellow. So it's a pleasure to welcome her on Parshat Shemini, you know, one of the almost it's the middle parsha of the Torah in many ways. That's you have a Darash is the middle words of the Torah we have in this week's parsha, but I don't think that's your topic. So Bakasha. Bakasha.
All right, here we go. Hi everyone. I hope everyone's having a great evening. I want to first thank Rabbi Kelman and Torah in Motion for organizing tonight's Parsha Shir. It's great to be here, and it's great to be able to learn and share some Torah with all of you tonight. So as Rabbi Kelman said, my name is Sarah Gordon, living in Teaneck. Currently work as a senior director of Israel Education for Unpacked for Educators. That's my day job. But when I'm not doing that, I really love to teach Torah, to learn Torah. So I really appreciate the opportunity for us to all learn together tonight. So our topic tonight is the story of Nadav and Avihu throughout Tanakh, which features the story of Nadav and Avihu in this week's Parsha, and Parsha Shmini. I want to spend some time tonight discussing and learning this major story. And I want to really do it in a couple of ways. Number one, we'll have a chance to delve into the actual story of Nadav and Avihu in the text itself, and we'll look at some of the traditional approaches as to what the sin of Nadav and Avihu could be. But then I also want to zoom out and look at some other narratives in Tanakh which feature some parallels to this story of Nadav and Avihu. This is sometimes called intertextuality, and it's really when we have different texts in Tanakh that share parallel words or phrases or themes and are almost asking us to compare and contrast them in order to reveal new interpretations or aspects that we otherwise might not have seen. And then we'll have a chance to look at, as we think about what these other parallel narratives could be, we'll look at the story of David and Uzzah in Shmuel Bet, occasionally read as the Haftorah for this week, but not this week because it's Parshat Chodesh or Shavuot Chodesh. But again, we'll see it's a similar story of celebration turned to mourning where someone's death seems to, someone dies or is killed when they seem to cross a line, but it's unclear where. And we'll have a chance to explore that. We'll also reference the Avodah, the service of Yom Kippur, and finally the story of Korach and the 250 Nesiei Ha'edah, the tribal princes, which also seem to have parallels to the Nadav and Avihu story. So that's our ambitious goal tonight, to look at the story of Nadav Avihu and the parallels and see what lessons and takeaways we can have from all of that. So with that, let's jump right in. And if you don't, I'm going to share my screen for the source sheet. In case you don't have it, I'm just sharing it in the chat as well. That's helpful for anyone to pull up on their own. And with that, we're going to start really with source number one, the key story from this week's parsha, the story of Nadav and Avihu. I'm going to read parts of it in Hebrew, but I'm going to translate in English, and you can follow along. And this over here is source number one. So again, the story starts off over here. We're coming off at the end of the days of all the different services that are dedicating the Mishkan, dedicating the tabernacle. And we end up here, Vayikra Perek Yod, Vayikra Perek Tet, with Nadav and Avihu deciding that they want to add something here to what's going on to the service. So we're told already, Pasuk Aleph, this is here in source number one, Vayikru b'nei Aaron, Nadav ve'Avihu, ish machtato, Vayitnu b'hen esh, Vayisimu oleha, Ketoret, Vayikrivu lifnei Hashem, ish zara, asher lo tziva otam. So Nadav and Avihu, sons of Aaron, they take their kind of, here it says censer, their fire pans, right? They put incense in it, and they bring this strange fire before God that was not commanded. Pasuk Bet, but it say ish mifnei Hashem, v'tochal otam, v'yimutu lifnei Hashem. Fire comes down, consumes them, and they die before God. Pasuk Gimel, v'yomer Moshe Aaron, Hu asher diber Hashem le'mor b'krovai akadesh ve'al pnei kol ha'am echaved v'yidom Aharon. Moshe turns to Aaron, attempting to console him, and says, you know, this is what God meant when he says, I'll be sanctified with those who come close to me. And Aaron, as we know the famous line here, Aaron is silent. Aaron holds his peace. The story continues with the remaining brothers being instructed how to kind of carry these dead bodies out from the Mishkan. And finally, Pasuk Vav, Moshe tells Aaron and the remaining sons to make sure that they do not take on personal mourning as they are Kohanim. But instead, and the reason why in Pasuk Vav, Pasuk 6, it says, V'lo tamutu, V'al kol ha'edah yitzov, so you won't die, and so God won't get angry at the whole congregation. That line will become important later on. And your brothers, meaning the rest of the Jewish people, will mourn this terrible, burning that God has kindled, this terrible incident. So this is our core text, the story of Nadav and Avihu. And I want us to really just think a little bit about maybe what we've heard in the past, what possible sins could have been that Nadav and Avihu have done over here. And I want to really share, I really want to share a few approaches to this before we have a chance to compare it to other people. So I'd love really just to hear what people have heard maybe in the past. What have you heard as to what the sin of Nadav and Avihu was in this text? And you can post it in the chat if you want, if anyone wants to give a live answer question, a live answer, raise your hand, or you want to just unmute yourself. I'm curious what you've heard in the past.
Can I make a suggestion? Asher lo tziva, they acted independently. You're supposed, that's not, that in itself was the objection to what their behavior.
Okay, great. Oren, come back to that, right? That like they got, this was not commanded. This was going rogue. This was, they crossed the line here in that sense. I saw someone post in the chat, right? Perhaps they got too close to the Mishkan. I'm seeing also people said they were drunk, right? And these are all interpretations that we're going to see. Arrogance, great. We'll get to that also. It's a hubris. So with that, before we jump into comparing the text, I wanted to try to organize all of the different commentaries. Everyone has different ideas as to what this sin, what did Nadav and Avihu do that was so bad that it merited this type of response from God. And I see another answer, right? Made fun of or wanted to supplant Aaron. Great. So I want to try to categorize these into three categories. And the first one, as someone said before, this is one of the, brought down by Rashi, is that they were drunk, that they were engaged in some sort of inappropriate behavior, right? You can look at source two over here. Rashi quotes Rabbi Yishmael, Omer Shtui Yain et Nasula Mikdash. They came into the sanctuary drunk, right? Teidash, Achar Mitatan, he's here in Notarim, Shaloich Mesu Shtui Yain et Mitidash. And how do we know they were drunk? Because of Smichut Parshiot, right? Because of what exactly happens right after this, the story, we cut it off at Pasuk 7, and I showed you here in source number 3, the exact next Pasuk, Pasuk Chet, and Pasuk Tet, Aaron is instructed by God to not enter the Mishkan intoxicated, right? So Rashi says, why warn, right after about drunkenness? It must be that they were drunk. Okay, that's our first approach. The second, and I'm going to kind of put a few different sources in this category, is that it was some sort of misdirected actions or hubris, that they had good intentions. Their thought was right or their intention was correct, but it was done in an inappropriate way that crossed a line. And you can't do that. You can't go rogue. And people mentioned this right before. And we see here, right, the Sifra, the Midrash really starts off in source number 4 and gives an interpretation over here by Chubanei Aaron, the sons of Aaron took. What happened? Afhan besimchatam, so too in their joy. They were overcome with the joy of the, the whole dedication ceremony of the Mishkan. Kevan shira'u ish chadasha, amdu leosif ahava al ahava. This idea of they wanted to add ahava, love, to love. That, God is bringing down this fire. Now they want to bring their own fire also. It's well-intentioned. It made sense in their heads what they wanted to do. It was good intentions, but as Rav Hirsch explains in source number 5, you can't go rogue. You can't make your own decisions, especially when it comes to the Mishkan, especially when it comes to what God is commanding, right? And he talks about over here, Rav Hirsch in source number 5, that the very authority of the Kohanim comes from the fact that they're doing what God told them to do. So if you're not doing what God told you to do, you're going to lose that sense of authority. And I'll just read the underlined part, right? Self-devised offerings would be a killings of those very truths which our ancestors are meant to impress. We'll skip a little bit again. Not by fresh inventions, even of God serving novices, but by carrying out that which is ordained by God. And we see this actually if we zoom out a little bit from our parak, right, which is happening over here. We're in parak yud, we're in parak 10. If we zoom back to kind of parak chet and parak tet, chapter 8 and chapter 9, where we're told about all the other preparations and all the other services that are being done in the 7 days of dedication for the Mishkan, what comes up over and over again with all these different instructions, and I underlined it, for example, in source number 6, in Pasuk Lamed Vav, Pasuk 36, when Aaron and his sons are setting everything else up, what does it say? That they did everything, Asher Tziva Hashem Biyad Moshe. They did everything that God commanded, in the hand of Moshe. And it tells us again, they're doing more services, Kasher Tziva Hashem, right? Kasher Tziva Moshe. What Moshe commanded them to, like, again, passing on God's commands. And this comes up over and over again. So again, almost highlighting that switch, this is Inesh Zara. This is not foreign fire. This is not done, Kasher Tziva Hashem or Kasher Tziva Moshe, right? They're going rogue here. I see some questions again or comments in the chat, and we'll get to that. And the final one, I think, that gets to this theme of misdirected actions, or, you know, they had good intentions, but they were crossing a line. There's a little bit of hubris. There's a little bit of arrogance there as well, to think that you can kind of make your own calls, right? And this is actually seen in the Gemara and Erevin, and it comes up in the Midrash as well. Very interesting interpretation as to what Nadav and Avihu could have done wrong. And the Gemara here quotes Bahatanya, Rabbi Eliezer, Omer, Lo Metu B'nei Aaron Ad Shehoru Halacha B'nei Moshe Rabban. What was the sin? That they died because they issued a halachic ruling before Moshe, their teacher. They kind of made their own call. And it explains again, you know, that, like, they decided that, you know, there's this mitzvah to bring their own fire in addition to the fire that God is bringing down. But I think the second approach, we really see these themes of hubris, or they had the right intentions, but they crossed the line. I want to share one more, and then we'll have a chance to see how this reflects in some of the other narratives where we see parallels to the story. And that is, this is number C over here before source 8, unchecked religious passion or an overfamiliarity with holiness. One that would cross a line over here. I see someone wrote, right, they didn't respect boundaries. And I think this is reflected in this approach as well. What's interesting over here is that this is not Nadav and Avihu's almost a first rodeo when it comes to kind of crossing a line in areas of Kodesh, or perhaps, you know, becoming a little too familiar. And we're actually told in Shmot Perek Chaf Dalet, here this is source number 8, that when Har Sinai happened, you know, most of everyone else was kind of just watching it from the regular, from the box seats, right, if you will. But Moshe, Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, and the Shivim Zikinim, the 70 elders, had like front row seats. They were, you know, front row seat here to what was happening at Har Sinai. And it says that they were able to get this kind of, you know, awe-inspiring, you know, much closer look at God, which is, you know, explained here in Pasuk Yud, right? They saw, you know, Livnat Safir, this idea of like the sapphire stone under God's feet. So a closer view. But what happens in Pasuk Yud Aleph tells us something very interesting. Ve'el atzilei b'nei Israel lo shalach yado. The nobles of the children of Israel, God did not send his hand. Why? Or here, we'll say, you know, it's trying to imply why. Because when they saw God, or they beheld God, they ate and they drank. So different commentators share that it could be when Nadav and Avihu here, you know, the fact that it says that God held back his hand implies that God was going to do something. God was going to strike them. This behavior of kind of eating and drinking when you're watching this amazing experience of God and from these very close up, was inappropriate. God held his hand back then and didn't do anything. But when Nadav and Avihu do almost the same thing, then they're struck down. And perhaps here, what that could mean by the same thing is this idea of there's an over familiarity, you know, with Kodesh, with something that's holy. That over here, and on one hand, you could see a certain positive element to it, right? Nadav and Avihu are so comfortable in the presence of God that they eat and drink. They're so comfortable in the Mishkan, they feel they can kind of enter, and it's not a place that they're nervous to enter. They can enter in, they can bring the Ketorah, you know, they can bring this new fire, and there's this big comfort level. But at the same time, that's inappropriate, right? Getting kind of overwhelmed to what's, you know, getting so into everything that you decide, you know, a little bit parallels here to the previous approach, that you're so comfortable here that you can kind of innovate, or you can, you know, are just so comfortable in holiness that you lose that little sense of awe. That was crossing a line. Essentially, you could think of like parallels, right? It's almost like the rabbi's kids, right? Running through the shul, right? I wanted this to be, you know, like we want people to be comfortable in Kodesh. And I think about this a lot. You know, when I was an educator, when I was formerly in the classroom, we used to discuss amongst my colleagues and I, you know, we want this experience for our students where they feel very comfortable, you know, with Torah, with what we're trying to do, with, you know, closeness to religiosity. But at the same time, you also want the awe. You also want that boundaries. And how do you kind of balance between the two? But perhaps here, this is a little bit of the problem, the Davin Avihu, of this being a little bit too comfortable, just like they were at Har Sinai. They cross the line and God is saying you have to kind of step back. Okay, so we saw the three approaches over here of what the sin could be, different categories. What I want to do now is I want to look at the stories where we see the echoes of Nadav and Avihu, where we see the parallels to their stories. And as we go through it, I want us to think about what the parallels are, what are the differences, what are the similarities, and we'll see through zooming in on how these stories compare and contrast that it can give us some additional insights on Nadav and Avihu, or perhaps on these stories, that if these stories are written almost echoing certain themes within Nadav and Avihu, especially now that we've thought out what the different approaches could be for what Nadav and Avihu did wrong, how can we maybe apply that to fully or better understanding those other narratives? So that's really where we're headed. Okay. So the next thing, section three over here, our first parallel, we're going to look, as we said, the story of David and Uzzah in Shmuel Bet Perek Vav, in Shmuel Bet Perek 6. And as I read through it, I'll read through in the Hebrew and I'll translate to the English. I want you to think about what sounds similar to the story of Nadav and Avihu and where the difference is really coming out. So the context of the source is David is now bringing the Aron, where it's been, you know, sitting in someone's house for many years, and he's now going to bring it up to Yerushalayim, bringing it back to Yerushalayim with a huge celebration, you know. And again, David HaMelech feeling, you know, his kingdom at least is at a point now where he can bring, let's bring the Aron up. So we'll start with Pasuk Gimel. We'll start over here with Pasuk 3. So what do? They want to bring the Ark up to Yerushalayim. Barakivu it's Aron al Elohim el Agalah Harasha, Vayiseyum Beit Avinadav Asher Begiva, Ve'uza Ve'achyo Bnei Avinadav Noagim et Agalah Harasha. So they put the Ark on a brand new wagon. They take it out of the house of Avinadav, which is who was hosting the Aron, and his two sons, Uzzah and Achio, are going to drive this new Agalah, this new cart. Okay, sounds good so far. And they go. Pasuk Dal tells us Achio is kind of like a little bit ahead of the Aron. Pasuk Hey, there is a huge celebration happening. David v'kol beit Yisrael mischakim lifnei Hashem b'chol atzeif roshim v'kinarot v'nevelim v'tupim v'nayanim v'betzalzalim. David and all of the, you know, the rest of Am Yisrael who's there, the Jewish people, are, you know, they're playing on musical instruments and all sorts of different musical instruments before, you know, as this kind of procession is going. Vayavo ad goren nachon, vayishlach uza ad aron elokim, vayochaz bo ki samtu abakar. And then when they get to Nachshon's threshing floor, Uzzah puts his hand up. I guess the Aron looked like it was teetering a little bit off the Agala, off the wagon, and he puts his hand out to stop it. And then what happens? Pasuk Chet, Vayichar Af Hashem, Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk 7, Vayichar Af Hashem, but Uzzah, God gets angry at Uzzah, Vayikehu Sham Elohim Al Hasal, Vayamat Sham Im Aron Elohim, and God strikes him down, and he dies there. Pasuk Chet, Vayichar Al David, Alasher Parat Hashem Peretz Be'uzah. David gets very angry about how God struck down Uzzah. Vayikra L'makom Ahu Peretz Uzzah. And he names the place Peretz Uzzah in, I guess, memory, right, of Uzzah, who was killed there. And David is kind of very, you know, temporarily, he gets his act together a little bit later, and we'll talk about that. He's kind of very, very upset about this whole situation. Okay. So with that, I don't want you to see the similarities yet, but I saw some people posted, right? Avinadav, right? People see the similarity, right? In the name, Avinadav sounds like a Dav Aviyu. Any other similarities that you saw between these stories. What echoes of the story of Nadav and Avihu do you hear in the story of David and Uzzah?
Somebody died.
Okay, good. Somebody died. I'll piggyback off of that, right? Somebody dies in a way that seems almost like an one could argue it needs explanation, right? Is this an overreaction? Why was this person? What did they do that was so terrible? We know that he tried to stop the ark. Doesn't seem like such a terrible thing, right? And they're killed. Good. Anything else over here? Any other similarities people see? Okay, good. Trespass, right? So someone posted trespass and touching the ark.
They were not commanded to support the Aaron, and they did.
Okay, very good, right? This was, I'll touch on both, right? There's some kind of like getting too close to something holy, or it happens around here, the Aaron versus the Mishkan. People just shared now, right, that they weren't commanded to, right? You're not supposed to, like, yeah, you thought it was a good idea to touch the Aaron. I mean, you know, people might, you know, you don't want it to fall on the floor, but he wasn't commanded to do this, right? There wasn't a command. It was never allowed, or, you know, you weren't ever granted permission to be able to do that. And here
Both in public, and both are involved with the Varbin Dusha.
Very good, right? Again, like connected.
Was upset that they didn't take it, the Aaron would carry itself.
Right, of course. And I think we see, as I put here in the chart, right, in source number 10, right, this is, both are happening in a time period of celebration, right? We're either dedicating the Mishkan, or we're finally bringing the Aaron, the Ark, to Yerushalayim. Number two, this big celebration, we went from one extreme to the other. It turns from celebration to mourning. Someone is killed and it's not clear what they did wrong, but they were struck down when approaching or touching something Kodesh, right? Something holy, something on this very high level, right? The Aaron, or again, entering, right, with the Mishkan, with their Ketoret, and the names, right? Avinadav, who's the bereaved father, right, in the David and Uzzah story, and the names in our story of Nadav ve'Avihu, right? So it sounds very similar. Couple of important differences, and we'll get to this in a minute, right? The reactions. Aaron is silent when his sons are killed. We're actually not told anything about Avinadav and his reaction, but we're told that David gets very angry. And what we'll see now is he's going to make some changes before he tries to move the Aaron again. So we've seen the connection, right? How these two stories are really, you know, being drawn together. But what can we learn from this, right? What are we learning from the fact that we have these echoes in one story of another? So with that, I think this story really highlights what we had said was one of the approaches to Nadav and Avihu's sin, and that was the third one, of an over-familiarity with Kedusha, with holiness, that leads to one then crossing the line. And I think we see this in the two changes that David implements when he tries again to bring the Aaron up to Yerushalayim. And for this, we're going to look at source 11 and 12, where the story continues. This is here in Divrei HaYamim, telling us about David trying again. So the first thing we're told over here, and David looks like he did some Cheshbon HaNefesh, right, some introspection to figure out what exactly went wrong. He talks to kind of like all of the Kohanim, Levi'im, that are going to help him try to bring the Ark back now, time number two. And in Pasuk Yud-Gimel, Pasuk 13, he tells them, What is it? Why did God kind of like come out and strike us before? It's because we weren't doing it according to what was supposed to be done. And I think someone mentioned or referenced this before, right? So he's like, so now we're going to do it again. And what's going to happen in Pasuk 10, Vav? Vayesu b'nei Levi'im, it's Arona Elohim kasher tziva Moshe kedvar Hashem, right? Emphasized over here. They're going to carry the Aron just like it was commanded to Moshe, you know, in the name of God. B'ktafam b'matot alehem. They're going to carry it on their shoulders. If you've seen like any of the, you know, images ever, you know, not actual pictures, right? But like drawings or anything people come up with, they always show kind of people are holding the Aron, right, with kind of like the poles, right? Everyone's kind of holding the poles and they're schlepping it, they're carrying it that way. And that really is the, you know, it's saying over here, this is the legal or halachic, however you want to frame it, you know, way, or the way that was commanded to carry the Aron. It's not supposed to be on an ark. It's supposed to be on your shoulders. So that's the first switch David makes, is now we're going to hold it on our shoulders. We're going to actually do it what we were supposed to be doing. No more, you know, switching things we're putting it on the wagon. And then in source number 12, This is still a celebration, but it's a little bit more of a serious tone. Perhaps while the last one was kind of like a big party, and this could be, you know, I'm going to argue here that perhaps it's a little bit more intentional, but it could also be seen as just, well, the last time we did this, someone died. So like, you're not going to have a full celebration. But what they do over here, I'll just, if you look at Pasuk, source number 12 over here in Shmuel Bet, first it tells us in Pasuk 13, Vayihi ki tsa'adu nosei Aron Hashem shishat tsa'adim, Vayizbak shor mari. Every six paces, this must have been a very long procession, they would sacrifice, they would do a korban. They would have a sacrifice. And Pasuk 14, David is still dancing, you know, as much as he can before the procession. But it tells us in Pasuk 15, V'David v'kol beit Yisrael ma'alim et Aron Hashem v'truah v'kol shofar. But instead of last time when we're told all the different musical instruments that people were bringing, now we're told it's the shofar, right? So I think there's a little more of a seriousness, of a solemnness over here that we see in this procession. It's more controlled. It's more tempered. And I think here what we're seeing is it wasn't just Uzzah's fault, right, that he kind of put his hand out to steady the ark. But I think this comparison between this story and Nadav and Avihu really highlights the issue with too much familiarity with Kiddusha, right? Here, the whole environment is one of familiarity, right? There's a huge party. And once you're saying that we're having this huge party as we take the Aron to Yerushalayim, then like, it's fine, listen, if the Aron's slipping, we're just gonna stop it from slipping, right? You don't have that tremendous feeling of awe. And on one hand, right, there could be this reaction. David is clearly very upset about what happened, that, you know, isn't this an overreaction from God? But at the same time, the message seems to be no, you know, Kiddusha or holiness is serious business. And this more relaxed atmosphere led to Uzzah thinking this wasn't a big deal, but it was a big deal. And he pays the price. I think we see the same thing, right, with Nadav and Avihu. This first by Har Sinai, this comfort with eating and drinking in the presence of God, you know, thinking that they now have open access to the Mishkan. And David here is doing a tikkun, right? He's trying to fix this by tempering the celebration. And now we're going to do it the way we were supposed to. And I think that's another, people mentioned that also in the chat, right? Another way, another parallel perhaps, right? Nadav and Avihu kind of crossing the line, maybe good intentions, but again, not doing what God commanded. And here, David saying, well, let's check. Like, what does it actually say to do? We're putting the Aron on our shoulders, not a wagon, and making those changes. And I think this leaves us really with this question that, you know, and I think it's a broader question, perhaps in Jewish education in general, how do we balance? Because I saw someone just posted, right, would it be better to let the Aron fall to the ground? It's a good point. It is interesting in the text. It doesn't seem to say that the Aron was in danger of falling, just that like the oxen kind of like stumbled a little bit. And there was this, you know, like, and that's a good question. And I wondered that also. I think here, perhaps it wasn't in danger, you know, actually of falling, but it was almost like, no, we're good. I'll just put my hand there, you know, and even just doing that, perhaps coupled with everything else kind of going on with the atmosphere, you know, God felt there needed to be a pedagogical point that was made, but it's a challenge. Right. And I see people posted, right, that both had good intentions, right? Interesting here also, right? We've got Eden. I see someone brought that parallel, and that's very interesting as well. And I think here, right, there's this idea. It's really this idea of how do we balance it? How do we temper it between the boundaries, but also feeling comfortable with wanting to approach Kiddusha? We'll come back to this, but I wanted to share one, and we'll see this theme in a different story, but I wanted to just share one final idea about the parallel between David and Uzzah and Nadav and Avihu. And this is a beautiful idea brought by Rabbi Alex Israel, who talks a lot in this. And I linked his article over here, source 13. Definitely feel free to read the whole thing. It's really excellent. He goes into a lot of these parallels. And he really takes another aspect of the comparing and contrasting. And that is the different reactions that David and Aaron have to this tragedy that befalls them. On one hand, we know Aaron was very silent. And David over here is spurred to act. He's spurred to make changes that are going to fix things, you know, for next time. He continues, and he also, and he gets angry at God as well for kind of what happened, or he gets angry in general about what happened. So again, what Rav Alex Israel does over here is he says that kind of by looking at the differences between these two reactions, we're really being given two models over here for approaches to tragedy. Aaron, who withdraws and is silent, and David, who's angry at what God does, names the place, tries again, and rebuilds. And he connects this to two responses that we can have after the Shoah, after the Holocaust. I'd like to extend it a little bit to where we're at, kind of at the Jewish people today, post October 7th as well. And I'll read just a couple of excerpts from this. So if you look at source 13, and I underlined it over here, the two responses that we have read, this is the second paragraph, that of David and that of Aaron should serve as worthy paradigms in our thinking about the Holocaust. On the one hand, silence should pervade in our response to the overwhelming tragedy of the Shoah. Silence due simply to our incapability to even grasp the enormity of the suffering, cruelty, and loss that is the Shoah. I'll skip to the end. Words cannot give any comprehension, so we mourn the loss we do not comprehend. We are silent. And yet, David throws us in another very different direction. David Amel says, let us rebuild. Let us continue to stride upon that royal path to bring God's name to Jerusalem. Let us tenaciously continue despite the inexplicable death. Let us rise above it, carry our Torah shoulder high with a fanfare to Yerushalayim. That's David's response. Action, persistence, soul searching, and rebuilding. So I love this quote, and I love this excerpt. And I think there really are, you know, these two kind of approaches or reactions to grief. And it's a tragedy. And I think we're shown both of them as two models that can be employed, right? And this, you know, connects very well to the Shoah, to the Holocaust. We have Yom HaShoah coming up in a few weeks after Pesach. But at the same time, I think we can connect it even now post October 7th, when we're all struggling with the sense of personal and national grief. It can feel very meaningful to reflect on how we toggle between these poles, between the Aaron pole and the David pole, right? There's the silence, the horror, and not even being able to process it and to have a reaction, right, to everything that happened on October 7th. But there's also being spurred to action, right? You think about all the different solidarity trips that are going on, all the volunteering and the chesed that's being done in Israel. I read an article recently that said that despite everything that's happened and how many residents have been pushed out of the South or evacuated from the South, there's large interest in lots of new people wanting to move to Otzef Aza, right, to the surrounding communities in the South, and wanting to rebuild and wanting to build it up.
What is the tragedy that David HaMelech is, as it were, celebrating in contrast to Aaron? I don't understand.
Yeah. No, I'm happy to clarify. I think over here, David is angry and upset about Uzzah's death. Why did Uzzah have to die? When it ends almost that story of David almost asking, I'm just going to skip back up over here, of almost like when, you know, David's afraid of Hashem, and it says over here, like, if Yavo Eli Aaron Hashem, how is the Aaron ever going to come to me? How am I ever going to be able to bring the Ark to Yerushalayim, right? So he's torn up over Uzzah's death and about how, like, it looks like his plans are stalled, that they're not going to continue. But he doesn't give up, right? And he says, okay, despite the tragedy, we're going to name the place after Uzzah, and we're going to keep going. We're going to try again. And this idea of, like, kind of rebuilding as a foil for the silence, and perhaps both over here are necessary.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. And with that, so that's kind of our first story and what we can learn, I think, from the parallel to David and Uzzah. I want to jump to another story that has some, you know, echoes over here of Nadav and Avihu, and that is the Yom Kippur service, the Avodah that is done on Yom Kippur, which happens a few chapters later. We are in chapter Yud, chapter 10. Now we're jumping to chapter 16 in Vayikra. And over here too, we're going to see over here that Aaron is told, and it's going to use the language of after the death of his sons, of Nadav and Avihu, that he can't enter the Kodesh, he can't enter the Holy of Holies, right, whenever he wants, but only in this specific way, only when he follows these specific instructions, these specific korbanot, these specific sacrifices, and the complicated avodah, the service of Yom Kippur, is described, culminating in Aaron using the ketoret, using the incense, as a way to almost shield himself when he does go into the Kodesh Kedoshim. Machloket, you know, debate whether that's, you know, now it's, you know, or then it was once a year, or whether this was any time that he wanted to go in, but we'll put that aside for now. But what's interesting over here, and I'll read part of it, and I want to share another idea that I think is going to echo a little bit what we've said so far about Nadav and Avihu. So over here we said, you know, source 14, it starts off pasuk Aleph, Vayidbar Hashem Moshe acharei mot shnei bnei Aaron bekirvat tamlif nei Hashem vayimotu. God speaks to Moshe after the death of the sons of Aaron, right, when they got too close to God and they were killed. And Hashem tells to Moshe, tell this to your brother, to Aaron, al yavo b'chol eit el hakodesh mi bayit leparochet el pnei hakaporet asher al Aaron v'lo yamut. You cannot go whenever you want in front of the Aaron, But Pasuk Gimel, Bizot Yavo Aaron El HaKodesh. This is how Aaron should go and and enter like the Kodesh, enter like the Holy of Holies. And it gives you the whole ceremony, right? Ending over here with using the Ketoret to go in. So I think what's interesting over here, and this is what I wanted to point out over here. I'm going to quote Rabbi Yair Khan from Yeshivat Har Tzion, who has an interesting explanation here as well. If this is told, that these instructions of the Holy Yom Kippur service or how to go in to the Kodesh are told to Aaron in the wake of the death of his sons of Nadav and Avihu, why is there a 6-chapter delay? Right? We're told the story of the sin of Nadav and Avihu. The whole story happens in chapter 10, right? Chapter Yud. Then we have, a whole 5 or 6 paragraph break over here, 5 paragraph break actually, until we're told of the Yom Kippur service. And we're interrupted in these two kind of between what happens with Nadav and Avihu, and then when Aaron is told how to fix it, like here's in the future how to go in. So what happens to your sons won't happen to you. And we're told about all these different chapters that talk about different types of impurity, whether it's forbidden foods, whether it's when a woman is a yoledet and she gives birth and the impurity that she's in temporarily, whether it's tzarat on houses, on our clothes, on our skin, all the different types of tuma that happen when people are ill or people who are a nida, right? Whether it's, over here, like someone who's a zav or a nida or a zava and all these different paraks, that perhaps we skip over a little bit when we're learning the parsha. Why this break? So Rabbi Khan really explains beautifully over here. There's a real reason for this. The break in the chapters is to highlight or emphasize for us the difference between human reality and divine reality. Now, if we're talking about the tikkun, the way that Aaron can fix what happened with his sons for the next time that he has to enter and make sure it's being done in a legitimate way, in a respectful way that's going to not have him, struck down or for future Kohen Gadols, he really needs to, you first have to have that break over here of these different chapters for us to really understand the difference between human reality and divine reality. Right? For humans, and this is not, tuma is not always negative, impurity is not always negative. It's just a reality that happens sometimes, when we're living our daily lives, right? People are having kids, their life cycles are moving on, all of these different aspects, but it's very, very different when we think about, what happens to God. And they want us to have this type of kind of introspection to realize this huge chasm that exists between humans and God. And we see really there's these two extremes, right? On one hand, Nadav and Avihu felt that closeness. They wanted to add ahava to ahava, love to love. They wanted to cross all the lines to just get close to God. Now, with Aaron, we're being told, 6 chapters later, after we can reflect on this, hold back a little bit. It doesn't mean you can't ever go before God, but there's a way to do it. There's a system, there's rules to follow, and realize and appreciate with these chapters about impurity in between that you as a human are very different than God. You're not equals. You can't go in whenever you want, right? There has to be that awe. There has to be that space, that acknowledgement of space. I'll just read this over here, right? The underlined part in source 16. From the beginning of Vayikra up to the revelation of the Shekhinah, God's presence, right? On the 8th day, the Torah addresses only one aspect of religious experience, the possibility of coming close to God. And he talks a little bit about what happens in Nadav and Avihu and how they're struck down. The next part that's underlined in this context, the parshiot, right, or the chapters relating to various types of ritual impurity come to emphasize the other aspect of religious experience and to teach us about the infinite abyss that separates between human reality and divine reality, right? In the last line, mortal man mirrored in impurity cannot come to God without the laws of purification that God himself commands. And I think, I love this idea over here because I think that on one hand, it's telling us that we really need to understand this difference between humans and God. And only then can you have a more tempered approach to get close to God. Doesn't mean you can't get close. You can, but it has to be done in an official way, right? Bizot yavo Aaron. This is the way that Aaron is going to enter the holy part. Not whenever you want, through this ritual. We need those boundaries, that tempering, that Nadav and Avihu lacked in their religious zeal, and their religious, passion. It's interesting. I saw somebody here, right, is asking a question about the Aaron as the Kohen Gadol and the sin of the golden calf. So perhaps a shear for another time, but there do seem to be a lot of parallels actually in the Yom Kippur ritual, the service on Yom Kippur, a little bit, and even in the Mishkan, even what we're reading now, to Aaron's role in the Egel HaZahav with the golden calf, and perhaps that there's both of these serve as a tikkun, or both of these might serve as an atonement for what Aaron did. But we'll save that shear perhaps for another time. So we've seen so far, we looked at one very parallel story, right, with David and Uzzah, and how we can draw out from that about the sin of Nadav and Avihu. And we saw the theme over there being too comfortable with Kiddusha, and we saw the differences between the reactions of Aaron and David. And now we're seeing with the Yom Kippur service again, with those break in between the story of Nadav and Avihu and the story of the Yom Kippur service of the Tuma of impurity, that we really have to understand that we're different from God, and that there really needs to be this tempering, these boundaries. Boundaries, if you want to be able to approach Kiddusha, holiness, it has to be done with rules, and it has to be done with boundaries and a real awareness of where we are at. And that's what we've seen so far. With that, I want to look, for the time that we have left, at one final textual parallel, one other story that really has a lot of kind of echoes in it to the story of Nadav and Avihu, and that is the story of Korach and the 250 Nesi'ei Haida, Korach and the 250 tribal leaders. So over here, we're going to skip now to section 5, our final section. We'll look at source number 17. And for many of us, where we might be familiar a little bit with the Korach story, we're going to start it a little bit already into the story. So I'll just give a quick recap, right, as we're probably familiar. We know there's a few different disgruntled groups of Jews in the desert that are all, for separate reasons in these different groups, annoyed and basically done with Moshe and his leadership. And Korach manages to kind of unite all these different factions that all have their different agendas and their different complaints into kind of a conglomerate of rebels, you know, that are done with Moshe, for lack of a better term. And it comes to whether it's because Moshe didn't get them to Israel, whether it's because we're all holy, we all should have a place in it. But there's all these different groups. One main group is led by Datan and Aviram, right, who come up as like the continual bad guys kind of in Tanakh, like the rabble rousers. And now we have another group, which is what I want to focus on, which is the 250 Nesi'ei Haida, the 250 kind of tribal leaders or princes, you know, of their tribe. And they're the ones over here. This is the group that I wanted to focus on. So as we know, Korach has kind of brought both groups, and he's, you know, they've complained, they've given all their complaints to Moshe. Moshe's basically done with all of this complaining at this point by the Jews. We're at the point where everyone in this generation has been, you know, doomed, kind of told they're going to die in the desert. And here's Moshe's reaction to that. Moshe decides, all right, you think that you can do better. You think that you can, that everyone's supposed to be holy. We're going to have a showdown. And this is the showdown that he suggests. So in Pasuk Tet Zion, right, he speaks to Korach before God, right? And he says, tomorrow, all of you, sorry, before God is what he tells the people, like, tomorrow, all of you are going to come lifnei Hashem, before God and before Aaron. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Pasuk 17. Vaikru ish machtato. You're each going to take your fire pans. Benetatem aleihem kitoret. You're going to put incense in it. Vikravtem lifnei Hashem ish machtato. And you're going to bring them all before God, each of you with your fire pans. Chamishimu matai machtot. The 250 of you, you'll have 250 fire pans. Ve'atav Aaron ish machtato. It's like all of you guys, the 250 with your fire pans, and Aaron with his fire pan. Okay? Pasuk Yudchet. They do it, right? Ve'ikhu ish machato, v'tznu aleim ish, v'yisimu aleim ketoret, v'amdu petach ol moed, u'moshe ve'aron. So the showdown happens, right? Everyone's got their fire pans. What's going to be? And as we, and then there's a little bit of a break where, you know, the whole community, Korach gets everyone to come and watch the showdown. Hashem wants to wipe out the whole nation, right? And Moshe and Aaron fall on their faces and plead for mercy, right? In that line, Pasuk Chafet, right? Al kol hayda tiktsof, right? They say to God, like, are you going to get angry on the whole nation just because of this one, you know, these rebels or this group of complainers? And finally, what happens at the showdown? Pasuk lamed hey, Pasuk 35. The yatzdam eit Hashem, v'tochal tachamishimu matayim ish mikrivei hakatorat. And fire comes down and consumes the 250, you know, it says over here, contestants, right? People, leaders, that were bringing the Ketoret. I don't want you to see the similarities just yet. Okay, I would love to hear. Feel free to post in the chat. Feel free to unmute yourself. What parallels do you see between this story and Nadav and Avihu? What are the echoes that you're seeing?
Hirsch says, Ish machto, in the case of Nadav and Avihu, shows that they wanted to do their own thing, Asher lo tziva. But here, Ish machtato, they're actually doing what they're told. So it's against Hirsch's explanation.
A very good point, right? This is a showdown that's commanded, right? Not a showdown that, this is a showdown where they're told to actually bring the Ketoret, right? As opposed to Nadav and Avihu, where it's totally of their own, you know, initiative. Here, it seems to be they're fulfilling a command. That's going to be a big difference that we're going to see for sure. Anyone else? I see someone write another story where Aaron is involved, right? Aaron's a big part of the story.
Both of them passed away in a different, strange way. Not in a natural passing away.
Very good, right? We know they're struck down by fire, right, in both. And that's an irregular death. That's not usually what happens to people, for sure. Anyone else? Any other parallels? Right, I saw someone wrote, right, alien fire in their own fire pans, right? And we'll talk about the almost exact language of what's described, right, of what they did. Anyone else?
In this case, Hashem is telling them, is telling Moshe and Aaron that he's going to annihilate them, the people who gave the incense. But in the other case, it came as a complete surprise. When the two boys, you know, nobody knew it was going to happen.
Yeah, good. And we're going to get to that soon. I think that's going to be a very important point of, like, and as someone mentioned right before about the idea that this was commanded, right? Didn't they know? This was like everyone knew what was going to happen here, right? Like they knew, assumedly, what happened to Nadav and Avihu, like this was commanded, and we, at least us for sure as the readers, know. And, you know, on one hand, if we think about it, wouldn't they have known also the 200?
Ostensibly, they were warned, b'mechubadai ekadesh, that was a warning in Shmot that this might happen. So that's what we've just heard is not necessarily correct.
I hear that. I hear that, but crossing
boundaries, crossing where you're supposed to be and trying to move up, or not being in line with really what your station in life should be.
Almost like I think almost like we saw that reflected in where the sins of Adam and Eve, almost like a hubris, right? Like I'm trying to move up beyond my status, right. my status or what my status was to be, for sure. And I'll just, for the sake of time, we'll just to continue. So I put some similarities and differences over here, right? In both stories, right? The similar language, ish machtato, by tnu bahem ish, by simol of katorat, right? The fire pans and the incense, and they, you know, are putting, they're putting the fire kind of like in their little fire pans. In both stories, it uses the line, va'al kol ha'idat tiktov, should God get angry at the whole nation? And then Nadav and Avihu story, Moshe uses that line when he warns Aaron and his sons to not mourn, because everyone else is going to mourn. He's like, and if you do that, God's going to, like, don't do that, because God's going to end up mad at everyone because of you. And here, Moshe kind of uses it in Aaron as like a defense of the Jewish people. Like, some people are messing around and being rebellious, but you're going to strike down everyone. The fire that comes down from heaven, right? People mentioned, right? Also this regular death, you know, crossing lines, boundaries. But the difference right over here, the Nadav and Avihu choose to offer Ketoret. Well, the 250 leaders are, again, I don't know if commanded, but are told, like, all right, you want a showdown on who's holy and who's chosen and who's not? Like, here's what to do. There's more direction. It wasn't initiated by them. Okay, we've definitely seen the connection between the two stories. Why are there these echoes here? What can we learn from the echoes of Nadav and Avihu that we hear in the Korach story? So for this, I want to quote, and I'm going to try to flip it actually a little bit. But Rav Amnon Bazak, another teacher at Yeshivat Har Tzion, who's really a master scholar in Tanakh, I encourage everyone to basically read everything that he's written. He's really excellent. So he talks about how the connection or the parallelisms between the two stories are really drawing on us to kind of learn something from one of them, one story, that we can apply to the other. Okay, so what does he feel that is? He says that, and I'll read the language for us. He says that, you know, in both cases, you might have thought that the sinners, quote unquote sinners in this case, acted out of positive motivation, right? They wanted to participate in worshiping God. Nadav and Abihu wanted to play a role in the dedication of the Mishkan, and Korach and his men wanted to share in the roles of the Kohanim, of the priests, and the leadership of the people. Yet, and here Rav Chazak says, that is actually not the case, and we learn that from this parallel. Yet I'll go back to reading the underlined part, yet our parsha makes clear that Korach and his men rebelled out of self-interest and merely cloaked their claims in the ideological argument that a holy nation has no need for leaders. From here, we can infer that Nadav and Abihu were also motivated by self-interest and not just by a desire for greater holiness. So what's fascinating here is where Rav Chazak says that what do we learn from the line, the connection between the two stories? That since we know, and he starts with this assumption, since the assumption in the Korach story is that everyone who's complaining, whether you're Datan v'Aviram and their party, or you're the 250 Nesiei Ha'edah, right, these tribal, you know, princes over here who are also complaining, all of the, we know from the Korach story, the theme is that people, you know, and someone mentioned this before, that people are motivated by self-interest, right? Are they really bothered about the fact that everyone's not equal, or are they bothered by the fact that they're not equal, right? And Rav Chazak says, and if we know in the Korach story that they're, you know, they're motivated by self-interest, and now we have this parallel to Nadav and Abihu, we can learn in the story of Nadav and Abihu also, as much as the classic approach, right, is, oh, they had good intentions, but they crossed the line, you know, and they just wanted to get close to God, but they didn't follow the rules. Maybe it's not such a charitable read. Maybe this parallel to the 250, you know, people who are teaming up with Korach shows that there was also a little bit of a self-interest there, something that maybe even goes beyond a little bit of hubris, right? This idea of, you know, so I mentioned this, right, wanting to rise above your station, wanting to be maybe it's not so much about familiarity with holiness or the Kodesh, but, you know, I can go in whenever I want, right? I own this, right? I have a certain kind of stature here, you know, whether it's like I'm our own son, or I have certain, you know, I was at Har Sinai and I have, you know, I closer seats there. But this idea that maybe there's also a little bit of self-interest, it's not as a charitable read. That's one approach. A second approach that I'd like to suggest is the complete inverse. I think we can take what Rav Chazak is saying is that the link between the stories is for us to learn from one to the other, but maybe we flip it. Maybe we say that just as with Nadav and Avihu, perhaps, you know, the simplest approach or one way of interpreting that story is that they had good intentions. They were good people. They just wanted to get close to God, but they acted in an inappropriate way. They didn't have those boundaries. They crossed the line, but in their hearts, they had good intentions of wanting to get close to God. And that's the charitable read. Maybe we can apply that to the 250 Nesiei Ha'edah, that unlike Datan and Aviram, you know, who consistently they're like the rabble rousers, like their group is like, you're the worst leader, Moshe. You never got us to Israel. You know, they forget that they're not going to Israel because of their own sins, right? Those people are like, they're the worst, right? Those people are the ones that are complaining against Moshe. They're causing all the trouble. But the 250 who are coming before Moshe and saying, isn't the whole nation holy? Maybe it's a much more charitable read of this group. Maybe this group really are these, you know, equal opportunists who just believe that everyone should have opportunity to get close to God and to be holy. Like they want to be like the Nadav and Avihu, in like entering them, you know, being able to enter, being able to get close to God whenever they want. And again, their request or what they want is inappropriate, right? Different people have different stations and you can't move up when it comes to Kiddusha, when it comes to holiness, but maybe it's a much more charitable read on the 250. Like they're not like Datan v'Aviram. They're like Nadav v'Avihu, right? Good intentions, bad actions. That's the second approach. And with our last few minutes, I want to give perhaps a third approach as well. And someone mentioned this kind of one of the questions before. Rav Chanoch Waxman, also from the Virtual Beit Midrash over here from Yeshivat Har Etzion, has a really, I think, fascinating, you should read the whole article and I put the link over here, really fascinating approach. But he tries to address the question of that when Moshe suggests this whole showdown in the Korach story, right, of everyone's going to bring ketoret, everyone's going to bring incense in their fire pans, and God's going to choose who he's going to choose, and that's how you're going to see what's going on. How did the 250 not remember what happened with the Nadav and Avihu, even though Moshe's telling them to do it? It's almost like, well, if you want to, here's a test to do. Here's what's going to happen as a test. Why go through with it? they know that Nadav and Avihu were killed from a fire from heaven from doing almost the exact same thing, right? You know it's going to end with death. Why do it? And this is the question that really Rav Waxman over here sets up in our last source, in source 20. And I'll just read the underlined part. Do they not remember what happened to Nadav and Avihu? Or do they think that their acts will not be considered a violation and that the challenge is in fact a real test, something other than a sophisticated death threat? Or perhaps they are quite aware of the risk of death, but are nevertheless willing to take their chances, right? Did they not know? Did they really think? And someone mentioned, right, well, Moshe is telling them to do this. Maybe they think that gives it legitimacy, but apparently they're also not satisfied with Moshe, right? So like, what's going on in their heads that they know what happened with Nadav and Avihu and they're going to do this test anyways? And the answer Rav Waxman gives is despair, which sounds depressing, but I think that, you know, can be maybe an empowering message as well. And he says that you know, there's different debates over when this story happened. I mentioned before there is an approach to that this story of Korach, we're not exactly sure what year it happens in, but it happens during the third, you know, during the gap years, basically, when the Jews are just wandering the desert and this generation is just waiting to die, right? And we have this whole break in Bamidbar of like silence. Like, we're not really told so many stories about this time. It's like a very depressing time period. And Rav Waxman says that, you know, really there was just this tremendous despair that the Jews had at that time where they were just waiting to die and they knew they weren't going to be able to go into Israel. And he uses this to kind of answer what's going on. And I'll just read the last kind of paragraph over here, right? So the second last paragraph, why do they persist? On some level, the answer can be stated in one word, despair. And I'll skip a little bit down. While God had not commanded Nadav and Avihu's offering, and it was truly a foreign fire, the incense test constitutes a different story altogether. It is commanded by Moshe and will surely not result in divine wrath. And that's kind of like the story that they're telling themselves, when really maybe the test was that they should have kind of backed off. This was like, remember what happened to Nadav and Avihu when they crossed the line, right? It's the same it's the same thing. If you think you're better than Nadav and Avihu, go for it. But really, they should have kind of stepped back and didn't do it and not do it. And I'll just read the last paragraph over here. Moreover, under the influence of despair, how hard would it be to engage in false hope? How hard would it be to imagine if just for a minute that maybe Korach, Datan, Aviram are right? And finally, I'll skip a little bit. If they do indeed die, which fate is worse, to die in a journey to nowhere or to die in a quest for the divine, engage in his service, sanctify like Nadav and Avihu, as Bikrovai Akadesh, as in I will be sanctified by those that are close to me. I think over here, I think this is fascinating, his take, that he's really highlighting the difference again between Datan Aviram and the 250. That it's still inappropriate what they did, but it's a more charitable read, right? They're just in despair and they're thinking, maybe God will choose us, right? Maybe we're different than Nadav and Avihu. Maybe we're better. Maybe our cause is just. Maybe Moshe is wrong. Worst case, we die, but we're going to die anyways. So like, maybe this way it means something. But ultimately, again, it's incorrect, right? It's good intentions, but it's crossing on the line. So with our last minute, I just want to recap everything that we did tonight. We spoke about Nadav and Avihu. We spoke about the different reasons for their sin, whether it's drunkenness, whether it's good intentions, but inappropriate actions and hubris. Whether it's having too much familiarity with Kiddushah, with holiness and crossing lines. We looked at parallels to the David and Uzzah story in Shmuel Bet, similar issues with religious passion unchecked and a lack of boundaries, right? And this just over familiarity. We saw the service, the Avodah of Yom Kippur, could be a tikkun and a rectification, right? For the sin of Nadav and Avihu, placed intentionally after the chapter is about impurity, right, highlighting the differences between us and God, and that we can't approach God whenever we want. We have to have those boundaries. And finally, we paralleled it to the 250 people in the Korach story, seeing that like it could be just how the 250 had wrong intentions, inappropriate intentions. They were a little bit more self-serving, maybe also Nadav and Avihu, or it's the opposite, right? Maybe we have a more charitable read, and we saw that with the brilliant insight by Rav Waxman at the end of the power of despair. Maybe allow them to forget what happened to Dov and Avihu. And I think the takeaways for us, firstly, as learners of Tanakh, is to always look for the parallels between stories in Tanakh and to think about what can be learned from these comparisons. And finally, here, the bigger essential questions can be drawn out. What are appropriate ways to relate to holiness? How do we balance fostering or wanting to create closeness with God with a relationship that also sets out boundaries, right? A question you can probably ask about all relationships. And finally, how do we view the characters in Tanakh narratives, specifically in Nadav and Avihu in the 250 Nisei Haidah? Do we view them more charitably or more critically? And what lessons can we take for ourselves? Thank you so much to everyone. Thank you again to Rabbi Kelman and to Torah in Motion. I'm happy to stay on if people have any questions in the chat or anything like that. Otherwise, thank you so much. And
thank you. Thank you. I think you got a number of the questions in chat, but you can take a quick look. And I'll just let people know. Of course, my shiur tomorrow on the Siddur at 9:15. We just started the Shmon Esrei last week, so we're going to get to Hashem Svatai Tivtach tomorrow.
Erev, do you have an email address? Because I want to send you something.
Sure. I'll post it in the chat, and it's on the source sheet as well.
Okay. All right. And then, okay, any questions, comments? Okay, otherwise here, I'm just...
Sarah.
Yeah.
Great shiur, great representation from Montreal and Hebrew Academy.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I forgot to mention earlier, I grew up in Montreal, so I love being able to connect again with Toronto through proxy. Yes.
I apologize for not mentioning that. That was a mistake on my end. I apologize. But it's not in your official bio.
That's true. I got to stick it in there somewhere, you know?
Yeah, you got to put it in there. Us Canadians, you know, we have to stick together. Okay. All right. Okay. Then, like I mentioned, Siddur class, Rabbi Liptak will be starting actually stuff on Pesach on Sunday. We'll send you all the Pesach information, hopefully just before or after Shabbos, in addition to the Yom HaYun. But this Sunday and Monday, our regular shiurim, Menachem Liptak, Benny Gesundheit, Mark Shapiro. Rabbi Shulman just finished, of course, his series on Kohelet, but he'll be giving a Pesach talk the following week, and we'll keep you posted by the emails. Okay, everybody, look forward to seeing you, and please invite a friend to come and join the learning. And thank you again, Sarah, and all the best, okay?
Thank you
How old are the kids? How old are the kids?
My daughter just turned 3, and my son's almost a year and a half. So.
Okay.
Sarah, I didn't get the email address on the chat.
Here, I'll post it again. Otherwise, you can definitely get it from Robbie Kelman also.
Right. Send me an email, and since I have permission to share it, I will do that. But here it is on the bottom. Yes, Sarah. Okay, there you go. Okay, everybody. Laila Tov.
Shabbat
Shalom. And be well.
Shabbat Shalom and Chodesh Tov.
Okay. Parshat HaChodesh Tov. And we'll have a chance to wish Chodesh Tov hopefully before Sunday, Monday. But yes, Parshat HaChodesh Tov. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Chodesh Tov. Thank you.
Chodesh Tov. Bye.
Chodesh Tov. Thank you.